Don't know whether I'm disappointed or relieved. Spent most of yesterday, Sunday the 7th of November, trying to get out of France. And now I'm back here in the same old barn, exhausted but whizzing. I'm able to write because it's getting light already, and Paul gave me a Benzedrine tablet last night to keep me going. Glad to have these notes back. I left them here so as not to have them on me if I was caught during the 50-mile trek to the landing field. Of course, I've told myself a million times I shouldn't be making the blasted notes in the first place, but I think I'll take them with me next time. Felt a bit like I was pulling myself apart to leave them here. And it's a treasonable offence to lose my pilot's notes. Rode in the boot of a small auto belonging to a chum of Papa Thibault's, a Citroën Rosalie. Four-cylinder engine, at least 10 years old, running, just on a disgusting mix of coal tar and sugar beet ethanol. Poor engine hates it, coughing and spluttering the whole way. Suppose I'm lucky I didn't asphyxiate in the exhaust. Papa Thibault has got a delivery van of his own for the farm, but it and his driver are so carefully regulated that they don't dare use them for resistance activity. On yesterday's trip, Sunday afternoon, there were no less than 6 checkpoints to get through, more than one every 10 miles. They don't always know where the checkpoints will be, and it was a good way to find out so we could avoid them on the way home after curfew. I was in the back with a wicker picnic hamper and also a couple of chickens, laying hens, which were legitimately being taken to another farm. The fuss made over the chickens at the checkpoints is not to be believed. Unlike me, they had their own papers. Dead clever distraction, though. As soon as anyone opened the boot, which they did at half the checkpoints, the chickens began to carry on like, well, like chickens. The difficulty for me, curled at the back of the boot under empty feed sacks, was not in trying to avoid heart failure every time somebody looked in on us, but in managing not to give myself away with hysterical laughter. It took ages to get to the landing field. Getting dark when we arrived, minus hens which had been dropped off at their final destination. I had to wait in my hiding place for nearly an hour while the hen transaction was completed, but they saved a sandwich and a drop of cognac for me. Then, onto the field. Bit of an uphill slope, but not too bad. Unfortunately, some high power cables in the approach which I didn't like the look of at all, and ultimately neither did the pilot, who didn't land there. I'll get to that. In addition to me and the hens, our carload included Papa Thibault's friend the driver, Papa Thibault for authenticity of chicken sales, Amelie and Mitraillette for authenticity of Sunday picnic, and Paul for general knowledge and execution of plan. Paul sat between the girls the whole way, with Amelie purring on his shoulder. She is a wizard actress, la cadette. Under the back seat, they had hidden a couple of Stens, Mitraillette's namesake submachine gun, and a wireless set. The field was right up at the end of a dirt track, 3 wooden gates to open and shut on the way. Guards of our own posted on each gate already. They'd all arrived on bicycles. Hidden in the wayside shrubs now, a few of the riders had doubled up so that when the aircraft passengers left, there wouldn't be extra cycles to take back with them. The local ground crew set up our radio by attaching it to the poor Rosalie's battery and sticking the antenna up a tree which conveniently hid the car from the air as well. Reception was all right at first, though as the wind picked up later it got more and more difficult to hear anything. We crowded round the headset as the BBC came on air, 2 or 3 of us to an earphone. Ici Londres. This is London. Such a thrill! No other word for it. Thrilling to hear the BBC. Just incredible. How amazing, astonishing is it that we have this technology, this link, all the hundreds of miles between us, field and forest and river and sea, all the guards and guns bypassed in an eye blink. And then that moderate voice, speaking clear French that even I could understand, as though the chap was standing next to you, secretly telling you in your blacked-out European field that your rescue plane is on the way. Paul introduced all the lads of the reception committee, not by their real names, of course. You have to shake hands with everyone. Hard to remember them all after one meeting in the dark. There was a girl who was supposed to be picked up with us, a wireless operator. They were dead keen to get her back to England, as she has apparently got half the Gestapo in Paris on her tail. "Don't know what we'll do without you, Princess," Paul said, squeezing her round the waist. "I'll come back," she said quietly. Not like Julie at all, really. Shy and soft-spoken. Must be every bit as brave, though. Can't imagine what nerve these people must have. Then Paul pointed out to me, "That young fellow just coming with the last bicycle is the other pilot, the one who got stuck in the mud west of here. You probably know each other." I looked up. It was Jamie. Jamie Beaufort Stewart. Even in tossing shadows and under a waxing moon, I knew him, and he saw me at the same time. He dropped his bicycle and we leapt for each other like kangaroos. He burst out, he nearly said my name. He caught himself and stammered a little, then smoothly cried out, "Ma chérie," and slung me over backward in a swooning Hollywood kiss. We both came up for air, gasping. "Sorry, sorry," he hissed in my ear. "First thing I thought of. Didn't want to blow your cover, Kitty Hawk. Won't do it again, I promise." Then we were both overcome with silliness, giggling like gormless idiots. I kissed him back very quickly so that he knew I didn't mind. He swooped me upright but kept one arm over my shoulder. They're all like that, those Beaufort Stewarts, affectionate as puppies, dead casual about it. It's not British. It's not English, anyway, but I don't think it's very Scottish, either. For a moment, I saw Paul watching us, himself with one arm still clamped round the other girl's waist. Then he turned away and said something to one of the landing team. "Any word from our Verity?" Jamie asked suddenly. I shook my head, didn't quite trust myself to answer. "Bloody hell," he muttered. "I'll tell you Paul's long shot." We went to sit in the car with Amelie, who had fallen blissfully asleep on the back seat. Mitraillette was perched on the bonnet with one of the Sten guns propped on her knees, keeping a good lookout as usual. It would be a couple of hours before the plane arrived. The reception committee were laying out the flare path, electric torches tied to sticks. Nothing for us to do but wait and watch till it was time to turn on the lights. "The long shot?" Jamie prompted. "There's a woman in Paris who announces a radio program aimed at the Yanks," I told Jamie. "Paul's asked her if she can interview the Orme Gestapo, perhaps include some propaganda supporting them in her show. Let the American boys on the battleships know how unfeeling it is of us to use innocent girls as spies and how well the Germans treat them when they catch them. The broadcaster's called Georgia Penn." "God, doesn't she announce that sickening No Place Like Home for Third Reich radio or whatever they call it? I thought she was a Nazi." "She's..." I couldn't think of the right word except double agent, which isn't what I meant, though I suppose that's what she really is. "She's not a courier. She doesn't carry messages. Who's the person a king sends ahead of his army and expects won't get killed?"
"A herald?"
"That's it, exactly. I should remember it's the name of the American paper she used to work for."
"What's she going to do for us while she's pulling off this positive Nazi propaganda campaign in Orme?"
"Try to find Verity," I said softly. "That's what this woman does. This mad American broadcaster, though her wages get paid by the Nazi Minister of Propaganda in Berlin, she walks bold as brass into prisons and prison camps and finds people. Sometimes. Sometimes she's refused entry. Sometimes she's too late. Too often the people she's looking for just can't be found, but she tries. She gets let in as entertainment for the imprisoned soldiers and comes out with information. She hasn't been caught yet."
Trusted wind, still howling all over France. A beautiful day otherwise, for once.
Well, the plane got there, finally. One of the Moon Squadron Lizzie's, lovely, familiar, ducky fuselage and diddy hawk-like wings. Would have been a tight fit with the three of us in the back, but we'd have made it, none of us very big. Anyway, it didn't land. Gusts must have been 40 knots, blowing crosswind over the landing strip.
pylons to tangle with in the approach, batteries dying on the electric torches we were using to light the flare path. Finally, me and Paul and Jamie had to stand there switching the lights off whenever the pilot climbed away and back on as he started another circuit of the field. The chap circled overhead for 3/4 of an hour and tried to come down 6 times before finally bottling out. I suppose it's a bit mean to say he bottled out. Anyone with half a brain would have done the same, and I don't think I'd have stuck around as long as he did. Moon sets about 4 a.m. at the moment, and it must have been down by the time he got back to England. Jamie and I knew he wouldn't make it in. Still, I was desolated when he climbed away and headed back west. We stood watching, faces to the sky in the dark and fingers gripping the torch switches. Only a few seconds and then we couldn't see a thing, of course, but could hear the familiar engine throbbing for a minute or two as it faded into the distance. Like the end of The Wizard of Oz when the balloon goes off without her. I didn't mean to. Couldn't help it. Let out an enormous, babyish sob as we trudged back across the field. Just seemed to howl at anything. When we reached the car, Jamie took hold of the back of my head and pressed my face against his shoulder to shut me up. Shh. I did stop, out of shame mostly, because the hunted wireless girl was being so stoic about it. Had to pack everything up and head back the way we'd all come, we refugees to our different hiding places. And now, of course, it was well past curfew and we didn't have the chickens to bluff with this time. Started bawling again when I had to say goodbye to Jamie. No, stop. You go back to Orme and look after Verity. I know he's dead sick with worry about her too and was being brave to make me brave, so I nodded. He wiped my cheeks with his thumbs. Good girl. Buck up, Kitty Hawk. Not like you to blub. Just feel so useless, I sobbed. Hiding every day. Hiding all day, everyone rushing around me, risking their lives, waiting on me all the time, sharing food when they have to account for every missing crumb, can't even wash my own pants. And what'll happen when I do get home? They'll probably send me to prison anyway for hoodwinking my CO, nicking an RAF plane and dumping it in France. They will grill us all and we will all defend you. They've not stopped any of us flying. They're desperate for moon pilots. You only did what you were told. I know what they'll say. Silly girl, no brains, too soft. Can't trust a woman to do a man's work. They only let us fly operational aircraft when they get desperate, and they're always harder on us when we botch something. All true, and what I said next was true too, but a bit petty. You even get to keep your boots and mine are burnt. Jamie burst out laughing. It's not because I'm a lad that they let me keep my boots, he said with just as much outrage in his voice as I must have had in mine. Only because I haven't any toes. That got a little choking laugh out of me at last. Jamie kissed me lightly on the forehead. You've got to look for Julie, he whispered. You know she's counting on you. Then he called out softly. Oi, Paul, I want a word with you. Jamie kept one arm lovingly around my waist, so like his sister. Paul came close to us in the dark. Used this field before? Jamie demanded. For parachute drops? The pylons are always going to be a problem for landing, even without the crosswind. Listen, old chap, if you can risk taking Kitty Hawk about in daylight a bit more, she's your best bet for field selection around Orme. She's a cracking good pilot navigator and a reasonable mechanic, too. Paul was silent for a moment. Aircraft mechanic? He asked finally. And motorbikes, I said. Another moment of silence. Then, casually, Paul asked, explosives? I hadn't even thought about it. But, well, why not? That's a brilliant thing to put my idle mind to work on, making a bomb. Not yet, I answered cautiously. Tough work for a slip of a lass. You willing to risk it, Kitty Hawk? I nodded like an eager puppy. Let's get those papers made for you and let you off the lead a bit while you wait for the next flight out. He turned back to Jamie and spoke in that nudge-nudge matey tone again, as if I couldn't hear and as if I were deaf. Bit of a dark horse, isn't she, our Kitty Hawk? Thought she didn't like men. Ready to go like a stoat with you, though. Jamie let go of me. Shut your mucky gob, man. He stepped close to our fearless leader in the dark, took hold of his jacket by the collar, and in a dead, quiet voice that had got dangerously Scots, threatened heatedly. Talk like that again with these brave lasses listening, and I'll tear the filthy English tongue free your heed, so I will. All right, lad, Paul said calmly, gently shaking Jamie loose. Back down, we're all a bit excited. What was left of Jamie's slim hand looked perilously small in Paul's firm grip. Jamie in general is nowhere near as big as Paul, a bit like a ferret going after a Labrador. At this moment, the air began to hum. Another plane was crabbing in as low as it could safely fly, two broad searchlight beams stretching and leaping towards the ground before and behind it. Paul reacted first and pulled a wireless operator under the shrubs where the bicycles were hidden. The rest of us threw ourselves into the low ditch that was the field boundary. No part of last night seemed to last as long as those 5 minutes lying trapped and defenceless in frozen mud and dead grass, waiting for the Luftwaffe machine guns to drill us into the packed earth or pass us by. Obviously the plane passed by. It didn't linger over our field in particular either, must have been on some kind of routine patrol. Don't like to think what would have happened if it had done its flypast while we were loading up a Lysander. It sobered everybody up. We drove the refugees and anyone else who fitted back to within a mile or two of their safe house. Three bicycles tied on the running boards and roof of the Rosalie, the motor car absolutely jammed full with three of us in the front seat, four in the back, two in the boot, and me and the wireless op riding on the rear bumper and hanging onto the roof like baby monkeys clinging to their mum. The idea being that if we were stopped, she and I would at least be able to jump down and make a run for it. No one else would stand a chance. It's marvellous, in a desperate kind of way, to opt for speed over subtlety, like screaming downhill to put out the fire when your aircraft's in flames. Every time we came to a gate, the two of us jumped down to open and shut it and took flying leaps back onto the rear bumper as the Rosalie set off again. You're so fortunate to be in the mask. The wireless girl shouted at me as we clattered through the dark. No lights, not even those useless slitty blackout headlamps. Didn't need them with the moon nearly full, though. Paul will take great care of you, and he'll do everything he can to find your missing agent. That will be a matter of pride for him. He's never lost any of his circuit before. Posh southern English with a faint French accent. My own circuit has collapsed. 14 arrests made last week. Organizer, couriers, the lot. Someone's leaking names. It's been sheer hell. They've been given to Paul for safekeeping. Shame he's such a ledge, but as long as you know... I can't stand him, I confessed. You have to ignore it. He doesn't mean any harm. Close your eyes and think of England. We both laughed. Suppose we were a bit high, keyed up with the Benzedrine, rattling through the French countryside in the moonlight. People we love and work with disappearing around us like burnt-out sparklers. Hard to imagine how dead we'd have been ourselves if we'd met anyone. Felt alive and unbeatable. Don't like to think of her being hunted. Hope she makes it out of France. I am Katharina Habicht now. It's not nearly as frightening as I thought it would be. The change brings such tremendous improvements to daily living that the additional danger's nothing. Who cares? I couldn't become a bigger jangle of nerves than I already am. I'm sleeping in Etienne's room now, hiding in plain sight, taken to extremes. I've also nicked some of his stuff. We cleared out a drawer to make room for Ketta's underthings and extra skirt, illegally scrounged with Julie's coupons. At the back of the drawer was a super Swiss pocket knife with a tin opener and screwdriver attachment, and this notebook, a school exercise jotter dated 15 years ago. Etienne's written out a list of local birds on the first three pages. For a week in 1928, Etienne Thibault decided he was going to be a nature enthusiast. sort of thing you do when you're 10, about the age I took Gran's gramophone to bits. The list of birds makes me sad. What changes a small boy from a bird watcher into a Gestapo inquisitor? No good place for me to hide things in this room. Etienne knows where all the hiding places are. Two loose floorboards and a niche beneath the windowsill, and a hole in the plaster are all crammed with his small boy stuff. He hasn't touched any of it for years. All of it dust-covered, but I'm sure he knows it's there. I'm keeping this notebook and my pilot's notes in the mattress, which I have slit with Etienne's own knife. I have met him. Trial by fire for Keter. Went cycling with Amelie and Mitraillette, my first sortie looking for landing fields. Three girls on bicycles, you know, having a jolly afternoon out together. What could be more normal? My bicycle is the one that belonged to the sentry Paul shot when I landed here. It's been remade. On our way back up the main road, we met Etienne coming the other way, and of course he stopped to bait his sisters and find out who I am. My evasive action consists of smiling like an idiot, hiding my face in my own shoulder as though I am too shy to deserve to live, giggling a bit, and mumbling. My French is not improved, but they have taught me a few responses to greetings, which I am allowed to give when I am directly addressed. Then let Mitraillette and her cadet sister do the rest of the talking for me. She's Mum's cousin's daughter from Alsace. Their house has been bombed and her mum's been killed. She's having a holiday with us till her dad finds her a new place to live. She's a bit fragile at the moment, doesn't like to talk about it, you know. In an emergency, they are supposed to say a code word, Maman, and speak directly to me in German. That's the signal for me to burst into noisy tears, which the girls will respond to with equally noisy comfort and cooing all in German. This performance is designed to shock and embarrass whoever is pestering us so deeply that they will quickly give us back our papers without looking at mine too closely, and run in the other direction to get away from us. We've practiced this routine and made rather a fine art of it. And every morning since I moved into the house, La Cadette, Amelie, comes and bounces on my bed crying out, "Wake up, Keta! Come and feed the chickens!" Suppose it's quite easy for them to remember my name, as they've only ever known me as Kitty Hawk anyway. So, we met Etienne. And of course the whole conversation was carried on in German, because not only do they speak it at home with their mother, but as their cousin I'm expected to understand it too. Every ounce of strength in me was invested in listening for the code word mixed in among their talk, which might as well have been Glaswegian for all I could make out. My maidenly blushes were not phony. Felt my face would catch fire with fear and embarrassment. I had to let the Thibault girls do the hard work of covering for me, explaining me to their brother as a cousin he'd never heard of before. But then Etienne and Amelie started scrapping, Amelie going whiter and whiter the more he talked. Expect I did too after a while, until I actually thought she was going to be sick. At which point Mitraillette snarled oaths at their turncoat brother and threatened to thump him. He went dead stiff, said something nasty to Mitraillette and started off on his bicycle away from us. But then he stopped and turned and gave me a nod, dead polite and formal, before he cycled off. When he was nowhere near an earshot anymore, Mitraillette burst out in English, "My brother is a shit!" Don't know where she learned that word, not from me. "He is a shit!" She said it again and switched to French, which was harder for me to understand, but easier for her to swear in. Etienne has been assisting at an interrogation. It is beginning to tell on him, and he took it out on Amelie, who had again poked fun at the fading bruise on his forehead. So he told her in hideous detail what would be done to her if she was a prisoner who refused to give answers when the Gestapo questioned her. Can't get it out of my head now that it's in there. I keep hearing it over and over, dribs and drabs from Amelie herself, who thinks I'm a good listener, although I can't understand half of what she says. She's partly upset by the Gestapo captain's involvement, as she puts him on the same shelf in her brain as her priest, or the head of her school. Someone in authority, a bit distant, mostly kind to her, but above all someone who plays strictly by the rules. Someone who lives by rules. And forcing pins under a person's toenails because they won't talk to you doesn't count as any rules that anyone has ever heard of.
I don't believe they'd do that to a woman, Amelie told her brother as we stood in the road with our bicycles. The pins go in your breasts if you are a woman. That was when Amelie gulped and went green, and when Mitraillette got angry.
Shut your trap, Etienne, you donkey. You'll give the kids nightmares. God, why the hell do you stay there if it's so horrible? Does it make you excited watching people stick pins in a woman's breasts?
That was when Etienne became cold and formal.
I stay because it's my job.
No, it's not exciting. No woman is attractive when you're pouring ice water over her head to revive her and she's managed to be sick in her own hair.
I tell Amelie not to think about it. Then I tell myself not to think about it. Then I tell myself I must think about it. It's real. It's happening now. What Jamie said is giving me nightmares. If Julie is not already dead, if she is not already dead, she is counting on me. She is calling me, whispering my name to herself in the dark. What can I do? I can scarcely sleep. I just go round in circles all night trying to think what I can do. What can I do?
Have found a super field. Rather far from here, though. Cycling all day with Mitraillette, Friday the 12th of November. Incredible how difficult it is to find a decent landing field for the SOE. It's all so samey, farm after farm, shrines at every crossroads, and a community bread oven in every village. The fields are so flat you could land anything anywhere, but there are never any good nighttime landmarks, or any kind of cover for a reception team. Must be lovely flying in peacetime. I have been in France 5 weeks now. My legs are stronger than they've ever been. Cycled a good 60 miles twice this week. Once to find the field, and again 2 days later to take Paul to see it. He needs to get his wireless op to send an RAF plane to take pictures for Moon Squadron approval. In between marathon bicycle rides, I spend most of my time taking care of chickens, learning how to wire up small explosive devices, and trying hard not to suddenly scream my head off with nerves. The broadcaster Georgia Penn has had a no from the head of the Gestapo in this region. A powerful and terrible man called Ferber, I think, the Orme captain's boss. Penn has let us know she plans to ignore his refusal and try again by going straight to the captain. She'll backdate her application, tie them up in their own red tape, right hand not knowing what the left hand is doing. An amazing woman, but totally crackers if you ask me. Hope her own right hand knows what her left hand is doing. Another Lysander pickup is planned for tomorrow night, Tuesday the 16th of November, at the same pylon-infested field near Tours. Weather unpredictable, but it's the last chance before we lose the November moon. I may go home with my munitions expertise untested.
No, I am still here, dratted Rosalie. Can't blame the poor car, I suppose, but don't like to blame the stupid, well-meaning driver.
Oh, I'm tired. Moonrise at 10 p.m. last night, so plane not due until 2 in the morning.
Paul came to collect me after curfew, and we bicycled to meet the car, him cycling and me riding behind him, standing on a bar wedged through the frame. Had to cling on to him for dear life for 5 miles. Bet he loved that. The car was late meeting us. The driver had to avoid an unexpected patrol. Paul and I stood for half an hour shivering and stamping around in the drainage ditch where we hid the bicycle. Don't know when my toes have ever been so cold, standing in icy mud, mid-November in wooden clogs. Thought so much of Jamie floating in the North Sea. I was nearly crying by the time the car arrived. There were only 3 of us along for this trip, dangerous in both directions. Didn't want to drag Papa Thibault into it. His friend, who owns the motor car, set off at top speed, full out and going like the clappers. No lights as usual except the waning gibbous moon on the rise. The Rosalie really did not want to go like the clappers and performed its usual consumptive drama every time we came to an uphill slope, coughing and gasping like a dying Dickens heroine, and finally just stopped. Engine still gasping a bit, but the car just stopped. Simply could not move forward up the hill. Choke full out, but cylinders firing pathetically as though we were trying to make the poor thing run on nothing but air. "Your choke's not working," I said from the back seat. Of course the driver didn't understand me, and I didn't know the French for choke, and neither did Paul. "Le starter," it turns out, which is not the same as the starter that might turn on your English engine. Unbelievable confusion followed. Paul tried desperately to translate, and the driver resisted taking advice from a slip of a lass, or whatever the French is for slip of a lass. I'm sure the direct translation in any language is more or less feather brain, as it's what I get called whenever I'm expected not to be able to do whatever it is. Fly a plane, load a gun, make a bomb, fix a car. So we lost 15 minutes arguing. Finally, as it was dead obvious that the choke wasn't working, the driver jiggled it about violently enough that something finally slid back into place, and after a few healthier-sounding coughs, the Rosalie reluctantly set off again. This whole routine was repeated, detail for detail, 3 more times, 4 times in total. The car stopped, I said the choke wasn't working, Paul tried to translate without success, we all argued 15 minutes, Papa Thibault's friend jiggled the choke lever for a while, and finally the Rosalie wheezed into life and trundled off again. We had now lost an hour. A solid hour, and I was fuming. So was the French driver, who was tired of being shouted at in English by a slip of a lass younger than his own daughter. Every time he moved off again, Paul would reach back and give my knee a reassuring squeeze. Till finally I thumped him and told him to keep his mucky hands to himself, so that even when the car was moving we were all growling at each other like tomcats. I was no longer afraid of being caught by the Nazis, or worried that we'd be too late for the Lysander pickup, both of which were more and more likely the longer we were on the road. I was just mad as a hornet, because I knew what was wrong with the car and they wouldn't let me do anything about it. When the car stopped, for the 5th time, I climbed over Paul and got out. "Don't be an idiot, Kitty Hawk," he said through his teeth. "I will walk to this airfield," I said. "I know the coordinates and I have a compass. I will walk there, and if I am too late to meet the plane, I will walk back to Orme. But if you ever want me to get in this French car ever again, you are going to have to make that French moron who is driving it open up the engine cowling so I can fix the choke right now." "My God, we haven't time for that. We're an hour and a half late already. Open the cowling or I will shoot it open." I didn't mean that, but it was an inspired threat, mostly because it gave me the idea of leveling my Colt 32 at the driver's head and making him get out of the car. He didn't even turn the ignition off. The engine was still gasping as we pried up the side panel of the bonnet with the tin opener on Etienne's Swiss knife. All was inky pitch black beneath it. The driver cursed and complained, but Paul murmured reassuring words to him in French as I was clearly set on getting my own way. Got one of them to hold an electric torch for me while the other made a tent with his jacket to hide the light. Oh, the screw that held the cable to the choke valve had come loose. Probably with all that blasted jiggling. The flap that is supposed to close over the air feed to the carburetor wasn't closing properly, and all I had to do was tighten the screw with my wizard pocket screwdriver nicked from the Nazis. I slammed the bonnet shut, leaned in the driver's door and yanked the choke on, and the engine roared into life like a zoo full of happy lions. Then I climbed back into my maidenly spot in the back seat and didn't say anything else till we got to the field half an hour after the plane had left. Most of the reception committee had left too, only a couple of them still waiting for us to turn up in case something awful had happened to us. I was too mad this time to think of Dorothy at the end of The Wizard of Oz. I gave the poor Rosalie such a kick in the front mudguard that I made a dent in it with my wooden clog. Everybody was shocked. Apparently, I've got a reputation for being quiet and a bit weepy. In a word, they think I'm gormless. Paul again, explaining. They couldn't have waited. It's so late now, it'll be daylight by the time they get back to England. They couldn't risk being caught over France in daylight. Then I felt dead selfish and bossy and mean and tried to apologise to Papa Thibault's mate in my rubbish French for denting his fender. No, no, it is I who must thank you, mademoiselle, says he in French, for you have mended my choke. And he held the door open for me gallantly. No suggestion that he had wasted yet another night risking his life for an ungrateful foreigner who would never be able to repay him. The aerodrome drop-off principle taken to extremes. Merci beaucoup. Je suis désolé. Thank you so much. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. Seems like I'm always saying thank you. I'm sorry. One of the reception committee stuck his head into the car after me. The Scottish airman said to give you these. Jamie left me his boots. True to my reputation for gormlessness, I blubbed most of the way back to Ormeau. But at least my feet were warm. Penn's found her! Georgia Penn's found her! Julie disappeared the 13th of October, and Penn talked to her yesterday, the 19th of November. Nearly 6 weeks. I don't recognise any of my emotions anymore. There's no such thing as plain joy or grief. It's horror and relief and panic and gratitude all jumbled together. Julie's alive. She's still in Ormeau. She's in one piece in her usual battle gear. Every elegant hair swept neatly into place 2 inches above her collar. She's even still managing to do her blooming nails somehow. But she is a prisoner. They caught her almost immediately. She looked the wrong way before crossing the street. Typical Julie. Oh, I don't know whether to laugh or to cry. So fed up with crying all the time, but too upset to laugh. If she'd had the right ID on her when they first questioned her, she might have got away with it. She didn't stand a chance without ID. Miss Penn had asked if she could interview an English speaker, and they got to talk face to face, under guard, and Penn verified Julie by her code name. She wasn't told Julie's real name. Don't know what excuse they gave. Penn came away fairly well convinced the whole interview setup was a complete sham, and Julie herself was being kept on a tight rein somehow. Invisible, but there. I suppose Julie knew that if she stepped out of line, they'd silence Penn too. I know Julie would never risk that. She didn't even go against orders and say her name. All information was passed in hints and code words. The captain and slave girl were both there, and one or two others, and they all sat around drinking cognac, except the slave girl, of course, in the captain's dead swanky office where Julie has been temporarily put to work as a translator. So, in fact, she's actually doing what she was sent here to do. No name given, no military service or rank mentioned. She introduced herself to Penn as a wireless operator. She has told the Nazis she's a wireless operator. Madness! That's not why she's here, and so now they've gone to a lot of effort to get code out of her. Penn hadn't any doubt they'd got code out of her. Must be obsolete or invented, but definitely something they can try to work with. Penn thinks that's exactly why she told them she was a wireless op. They call it WT in SOE, wireless telegraphist, so she could give them code. It's more common for a girl in SOE to land in France as a courier, but if Julie had told them she was a courier, they'd have grilled her about her circuit. Obsolete code is safer to betray, I suppose, than real-life people. And it's straight truth in terms of Julie's original training at her WAAF commission, and it goes along with the pictures they took at the crash site, which they've certainly shown her by now. As long as they're focused on her non-existent wireless activities, they won't ask her about Operation Blow Up the Ormeau Gestapo Headquarters, or whatever it's really called. Penn was shown only a few of the administrative offices and an empty dorm room with 4 tidy beds in it. No contact with any other prisoners and no sign of the conditions they're kept in. Julie gave her some clues. She said, she... Julie was...
Blast it!
Fly the plane, Maddie.
I will not cry. I got to talk to Miss Penn myself. Mitrayette and I met her by a little pond in a posh residential area of Orme and sat on a bench winding yarn while we talked. One of us girls on each side of Miss Penn and a canvas bag in her lap full of worn-out woolly socks to be unravelled. She must have looked like our nanny. She's nearly a foot taller than either of us. She talked, and we kept dipping into the bag for more yarn while we listened. Suddenly, in the middle of her report, as I reached for another sock, Miss Penn took hold of my hand and held it tight. Just mine, not Mitrayette's. Don't know how she guessed that I was the one who would take it hard. A bit of an interrogator herself, now that I think about it. Same job as the rest of them, pulling sensational stories out of reluctant sources. They all do it differently, but it's the same job. And Julie, also an expert, made it easy, volunteering information that Penn didn't ask for.
You feeling brave, Kitty Hawk?
Penn said, holding my hand tightly. I gave her a sort of grimace of a smile. I suppose.
There's no nice way to tell you this, Penn said, and her crisp, no-nonsense American voice was angry. We waited. Penn told us quietly. She's been tortured.
Couldn't answer for a minute. Couldn't do anything.
Probably seemed quite sullen. Not surprised, really, but Penn was so frank, it felt like being hit in the face. Finally, I croaked stupidly. Are you sure?
She showed me, Penn said. She was pretty clear about it. Adjusted her scarf as soon as we'd shaken hands, gave me a good look. Ugly row of narrow, triangular burns across her throat and collarbone. Just beginning to heal. Looked like it had been done with a soldering iron. More of the same all along the insides of her wrists. She was very clever about showing me. Cool as you please, no drama about it. She'd give her skirt a twitch as she crossed her legs, or let her sleeve ruck back as she took a cigarette. Only moving when the captain was looking somewhere else. Ghastly bruises on her legs. But the marks are fading now. Must have all been done 2 or 3 weeks ago. They've eased off on her. Don't know why. She's made some kind of deal with them, that's for sure, or she wouldn't still be here. You'd have thought by now Orme would have either got what they wanted out of her or given up.
Made a deal with them, I choked.
Well, some of us managed to pull it off. Miss Penn gently guided my hand back to the bag of socks. Then she confessed, hard to tell what your friend thinks she's doing, though. She was focused. She didn't expect to hear her own code name come up in the conversation and shook her. But she didn't, you know, she didn't hint at rescue. I think she's still dead set on completing her assignment, and has reason to believe she can do it from the inside. Miss Penn gave me a sideways glance. Do you know what her assignment was?
No, I lied.
Well, Miss Penn said, here's what she told me. Maybe you can make something of it.
But I can't. I don't know what to do with any of it. It's like, it must be like paleontology, trying to put a dinosaur together based on a few random bones and you don't even know if they're all from the same kind of animal. I'll write down what Julie's given us, though. Perhaps Paul will make sense of it. Number one. The building the Gestapo use in Orme has got its own generator. Penn was complaining about power cuts and how annoying it is not to be able to count on electricity when you work in radio, and Julie said, well, here we make it ourselves. How like her to talk as if she'd become one of them. Like the time she took me to see Colonel Blimp and sat there weeping all through the scene where the imprisoned German officers are listening to Mendelssohn. Number two. The fuse box is under the grand staircase. Miss Penn didn't say how our Julie managed to communicate that. Did also mention, number three, it is a known fact that the Nazis have a wireless office across the square from the Gestapo headquarters in the town hall. And according to Julie, this must be because there is no regular broadcasting setup in the Chateau de Bordeaux building. Penn thinks because the walls are too thick for good reception. But I reckon the generator interferes with the reception more than the walls. This information was passed dead casually. SOE call radio work arthritis. Easy peasy. Can just imagine Julie studying her nails. Fortunately, I don't suffer from stiff joints. No one does here. How these Nazis would take advantage. Number 4. Penn also found out a lot about the slave girl's secretary. Julie thinks she is about to have a crisis of conscience, which we might be able to take advantage of. Suggests we watch her and make it easy for her to find a resistance contact when she's ready. It boggles me trying to think how Julie managed to communicate all this with the Gestapo captain listening. Apparently, they were speaking English, and the slave girl had to translate for the captain. So either she just didn't get it or she put up with it, which partly proves Julie's point. Julie calls her the angel. L'ange. Dead embarrassing, if you ask me. No wonder the poor girl keeps mum. It's masculine, too, in French, not just a plain noun like it is in English. It is a direct translation of her surname. Engel, from the German. Sometimes Julie used to make me jealous. Her cleverness. Her ease with men, how posh she is, the grouse shooting in the Swiss school and speaking 3 languages and being presented to the king in a blue silk ball gown. Even her MBE after she caught those spies, like being knighted. And especially her term at Oxford. And I hate myself for ever having thought any of it was worth envying. Now all I can think of is where she is. And how much I love her. And I start to cry again. I dreamed I was flying with Julie. I was taking her home, flying up to Scotland in Dibner's Pussmoth. We were heading up the coast along the North Sea, the sun hanging low in the west, sky and sea and sand all gold, gold light all around us. No barrage balloons or anything. Just empty sky like in peacetime. But it wasn't peacetime. It was now. Late November 1943, with the first snow on the Cheviot Hills in the west. We were flying low over the long sands at Holy Island, and it was beautiful. But the plane kept trying to climb, and I was fighting and fighting to keep it down, just like the Lysander. Scared and worried and tired all at once. Angry at the sky for being so beautiful when we were in danger of crashing. Then Julie, sitting alongside me, said, "Let me help." In the dream, the Pussmoth had dual controls, side by side like a tipsy, and Julie took hold of her own control column and gently pushed the nose forward, and suddenly we were flying the plane together. All the pressure was gone, nothing to be afraid of, nothing to battle against. Just the two of us flying together, flying the plane together side by side in the gold sky. "Easy peasy," she said, and laughed. And it was. Oh, Julie, wouldn't I know if you were dead? Wouldn't I feel it happening, like a jolt of electricity to my heart? Amelie has just seen an execution. At the Chateau de Bordeaux. Chateau des Bourreaux is what everybody calls it now. Castle of Butchers. The kids here get Thursday off school instead of Saturday. And Amelie had gone into Orme with a couple of her chums to a cheap cafe they like. Which happens to be at the end of the low lane at the back of the Gestapo building. Amelie and her friends were sitting in the cafe window. Noticed a crowd gathering in the lane. Being kids, they piled along to see what was going on. Turns out those bastards had got a guillotine rigged up in their rear courtyard and were executing people. The kids saw. They didn't know what was going on, or they'd have never gone to look, Amelie says, but they arrived just as it was happening, and they saw it. Saw it happen. She has been sobbing her heart out all evening, impossible to comfort her. They saw a girl killed, and Amelie recognized her from school. Though the girl had been a few years ahead of Amelie and had already finished. What if it had been Beryl? Or Beryl's sister? Because that's what it's like. Schoolmates being guillotined as spies. I didn't understand before. Really didn't understand. Being a kid and worrying that a bomb might kill you is terrible. But being a kid and worrying that the police might cut your head off is something else entirely. I haven't words for it. Every fresh, broken horror here is something I just didn't understand until I came here. When I was 8, before the Depression, we had a holiday in Paris. I remember bits of it. We took a boat trip on the Seine, and we saw the Mona Lisa. But the thing I remember most is how Grandad and I went to the top of the Eiffel Tower. We took the lift up, but we walked the whole way down, and on the way, we stopped at the first stage, and we could see Grand standing in the park below, wearing a big new hat she'd bought that morning. And we waved at her. She looked so posh, all alone in the Champ de Mars, that you'd have never known she wasn't French herself. She took a picture of us, and though we were so far away and tiny you can't see us in the picture, I know we're there. And I remember also there was a shop way up there on the first stage, and Grandad bought me a tiny gold Eiffel Tower on a gold chain as a souvenir, and I still have it, back home in Stockport. It wasn't so long ago. What is happening to us?
Maman Thibault has been dosing Amelie with café au lait at the big kitchen table, Mitraillette and I taking turns holding her tight and exchanging horrified glances over her head. She won't stop talking. I only get every third word or so. Mitraillette whispers a rough translation.
Il y en avait une autre.
There was another.
Il y avait deux filles.
There were two girls.
La cadette et ses amis n'ont rien vu quand on a tué l'autre.
They didn't see the second girl executed. It was torment for all of us, dragging this information out of La cadette. There were two girls brought there together, tied to each other. The second had to stand and watch as they butchered the first. So close, they made her stand, so close that Amelie said the blood spattered on her face. Then they closed the gates. Over the courtyard wall, Amelie and her friends saw them raising the blade again, and that was when they left. The second girl was Julie. Certain of it. There can't be another petite blonde in a pullover the colour of autumn leaves being held prisoner in the Orme Gestapo headquarters. Amelie saw her. But I don't believe they killed her either. I just don't believe it. I keep thinking of those pictures of the pilot. They must have shown Julie those pictures by now, and perhaps she thinks I'm dead. But I'm not. And it's the same for her, I'm sure of it. It might look like she's dead, but she's not. They've got a reason to fake her death now, since Georgia Penn talked to her this week and they need to re-establish their supremacy, or whatever, their control over what everybody knows or doesn't know. That captain, or commander, must be in trouble. He went behind his superior's back to let Penn in. Perhaps he's been told to kill Julie, but I think he's just as likely been told to stage her death so she disappears again. Sharing cognac with her and sending her to the guillotine in the same week? I just don't believe it. I want to blow that place apart. Planes go over almost every night. There are some munitions factories working for the Germans and launch sites here in France that they are desperate to put out of action. They won't drop a bomb in the middle of Orme, not on purpose, for fear of hitting civilians. They have hit the railway junction here and had a go at the factories to the north of the city, though I don't think Orme carries on any significant manufacture apart from umbrellas. But the RAF won't bomb the middle of the city. It's why Julie was sent here, so we could get at it from the ground. Not many people here know the RAF is trying to avoid hitting them. No one feels safe. The Americans dropped some bombs on Rouen in broad daylight. People panic when they hear the air raid sirens and dive for shelter just like we did back in the Manchester Blitz. but nothing ever hits the center of Ormay. Sometimes I wish it would. Just one great big blast to wipe out the castle of butchers. I want that evil place to go up in flames. I want it so badly it hurts. Then I remember that Julie is inside. I don't believe she's dead. I don't believe any of their bluff and lies and bullying threats. I don't believe she's dead, and I won't believe she's dead until I hear the shots myself and see her fall. Another Nazi Sunday dinner at the Thibaut's, 28th of November. Had to make myself scarce. Can just imagine Lacadette feeding them our line. Keta has got an older man. You would not believe how fast she works. It's a friend of Papa's driver. She met him when we were loading hens a couple of weeks ago. They go out together every Sunday and some evenings too. And Maman, rolling her eyes. It's not right, not right for such a young girl. He's twice her age. But what can I do to stop her? She's not my own. We work her hard and she gets no wages, so I have to give her Sunday afternoons. And she's of age. I just hope she's careful, doesn't get herself in trouble.
In trouble? With Paul?
He and I bicycled off together to someone else's house to refine my bomb-making and gun-firing skills. It's such a relief to focus on some neutral thing. How much plastic explosive you need to blow up a car. How to wire up the switches. How to use a magnet to attach a detonator. How to hit a moving target with a pocket pistol. A borrowed one, as Keta doesn't normally carry a gun, since she would get arrested if she was caught with it. Thank you, Jamie and Julie Beaufort Stewart, for the first few shooting lessons. Today's moving target was not an ME-109 or a pheasant, but an empty tin on a stick, waved about by a very brave soul at the other end of the garden. The noise is hidden by the sound of a sawmill adjacent to the house. I don't know if they normally work on a Sunday afternoon or if the noise was laid on specially for us. "It is a pity we cannot keep you, Kitty Hawk," said the man whose house it was. "You were born to be a soldier." Makes me quite puffed up with pride and yet fills me with scorn all at the same time. What rubbish! I wasn't born to be a soldier. There's a war on, so I'm delivering aeroplanes, but I don't go looking for adventure or excitement, and I jolly well don't go around picking fights with people. I like making things work. I love flying. Have to remind myself I am still Maddie. Haven't heard my own name for 7 weeks. And my stunt double, Keta, is going to be pushed to her limits in the next few days. I am supposed to deliver the message. Invitation? To Julie's recruit, the German slave girl secretary, Engel. Why me? Because I'm not local, and with luck, I won't still be here after the next full moon. Engel doesn't know my face, very few people do. But I hadn't ever seen her before today. So he arranged for me to get a good look at her before I have to approach her in the street tomorrow. Paul and I came back to the Thibaut's farm before the Nazi visitors left, and we waited. Waited. Waited for them to come out. We'd closed the gate, so the Gestapo Mercedes had to stop, and Engel, who is their driver, had to get out to open the gate. There was me, standing at the side of the road with my murdered man's bicycle, waiting well back from the murk with my head down and wearing one of Maman Thibaut's motherly kerchiefs. There was Paul, feeling up the German girl, bold as brass. I'm sure no one gave me a second glance because what a performance he put on. He let the poor lass get the gate open about a foot or so, then put one of his big hands over hers to help, right? But he managed to get his other hand spread across her bum as they pushed the gate open together. I think it is safe to say she now hates him as much as I do. She scurried back to the car, clutching her coat and skirt tight around her legs, and Etienne was in the back seat laughing. But all Paul's fooling about did give me a good look at her. She's tall, about my age, dark brown hair in a severe crimped bob. Bit old-fashioned. Astonishing pale green eyes.
Not pretty, but interesting. She'd probably be a knockout in a red cocktail dress, but looked dead frowny and drab in her sensible shoes and dust-coloured overcoat. Oh, I sound like Julie. I say, Nazi slave girl, you'd look super.